forever. It will never ever change.
Night.
And the feelings right.
Oh, it's debate night.
Oh, God.
Oh, and what a night.
Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I'm Jennifer Smith.
And I'm Stephanie Murray, and I'm very happy to be back in the pod bunker with Jen. I feel like we haven't done this together in a very long time.
It's true. I think it's mostly because Steve wants us to stop talking about the things that really matter in life, like Caroline Calloway and The Bachelor, and the only way to stop that from happening is to make sure that we're talking to him about healthcare.
Yep, but now we are together, and we just wasted about 20 minutes in the bunker talking about The Bachelor, Caroline Calloway,
yeah,
so on and so forth.
Screening.
But we do have important information to tell you before we get to the pod. We're having a live event next month.
Yes, we're going to be having a live event at the WeWork Boston on One Beacon. So not the place we were last time, but the place we were before that, the normal location. And it's going to be Wednesday, March 4th from 6 to 8 p.m. Details to come. But hey, we're so excited to see you guys there.
Yes, we are. It's going to be so much fun. They're always so much fun.
It's true. You get to hang with all of the Mappily residents.
And we don't really get to do any outtakes, which is also kind of funny because it's live.
Yeah, it's true. Libby's constantly, you know, producing there, waiting for us to drop an F-bomb. And it hasn't happened yet. But who knows? Maybe this time.
You have to come to the live event to find out.
So why are we here? We're not recording live right now, but I don't know. There may have been some F-bombs dropped last night while we were watching the Massachusetts Senate debate.
Maybe at your house.
You were there. I hope you weren't cussing.
That's right. So we're here to talk about the first time that Joe Kennedy and Ed Markey met on the debate stage last night. And then Steve did an interview with State Senator Cindy Friedman and Julian Sear about a mental health bill that the Senate just passed.
Right. But first, Stephanie, can we talk about the truly wild day in Lowell?
And it just kind of keeps getting crazier.
It's the never-ending wild day.
So State Rev Dave Nangle, he's a Lowell Democrat. He was arrested on Tuesday morning. And the way that this all played out was kind of crazy. So the U.S. attorney, Andrew Lelling, instead of sending out like a press release or anything, he just dropped a tweet that it had happened.
Yeah.
And they were going to have a press conference within like an hour and a half. So then everybody rushes to the courthouse for the press conference. And it turned out that Nangle had really misused his campaign funds for all sorts of stuff that stemmed from kind of gambling and buying flowers for his girlfriend and
golf club dues.
All sorts of things.
Campaign finance violations. So, I mean, he was indicted on 28 charges. It was truly insane. And I did love, apparently, some people were tweeting at you, this is what happens when you have a casino in Boston.
I don't know if we can blame the casino for wire fraud, bank fraud, false statements to a bank, filing false tax returns, but there was a lot of gambling involved. You know, we're laughing, but these charges are very serious.
Yeah.
Nangle just resigned his leadership post in the House. He was kind of a top lieutenant to House Speaker Bob D'Elia. So he hasn't resigned his seat, but he did kind of resign his committee post and his leadership post. And the thing that I found really interesting about this was Lelling, the U.S. attorney. He, during the press conference, he said that it was important that his office go after these kind of crimes because nobody else will, or maybe nobody else would, and that he would continue doing it. So I'm not sure if that was a warning or if who it was a warning to. I didn't realize
it
that people
like
were
a warning shot.
Doing this with their campaign funds, but it sounded like a warning shot. Of course, we should remember that he was appointed by the Republican president, so going after Democrats has been something he's interested in.
Yeah, that's true. And this isn't the first time that we've seen elected officials in Massachusetts doing kind of sketchy things with their campaign funds. So we're going to leave it there.
Oh, boy. But I mean, this is just a shameless plug for the Lowell Sun, my hometown paper, which I love. They just had the greatest details in their story about this. They sent one of the editors to Nangle's house right after he was arrested, and one of his aides was kind of outside and inside the house with a black trash bag. Just all of these really interesting, colorful details about that day.
Yeah, local journalism, folks. Support local journalism. They're there to report on all of the sketchy black trash bag activities.
So we'll be keeping an eye on this and reading our Lowell Suns for the weeks and months ahead. This isn't going away anytime soon, but let's move on to the Kennedy-Markey debate.
Let's go. It feels like just yesterday we were all speculating about a mysterious poll circulating through the Commonwealth, asking voters their views on a potential Ed Markey versus Joe Kennedy Senate race matchup. Much has transpired since then, including the withdrawal of two other Senate candidates, New Bedford-raised businessman and author Steve Pemberton and Brookline Labor attorney Shannon Liss Reardon. Now only two remain, that rumored matchup to begin with, and the fateful day arrived for the two to square off in a verbal sparring match. Yesterday, WGBH hosted a debate between the two, and let's get into it. Stephanie, how'd you feel?
Well, Jen, it was a relief to me to watch a debate between two people instead of 8 or 10 like we've been subjecting ourselves to in the Democratic presidential primary for the last year. And it was exciting for me to see Kennedy and Markey finally meet for months in September. And even before that, we've been talking about this matchup. And there have been kind of rumblings and tweets and endorsements. But there hasn't been a moment where they finally had to face each other. And so we got that last night.
Yeah, you know what kind of got me is I was almost surprised, though I don't know if I should have been, that even after all of these kind of individual interviews that they were doing, including, hey, we love the shameless plug here, Joe Kennedy was on the horse race a little while ago right after he announced. But so both of these folks have been doing their sort of press tour about why Markey thinks he should keep the seat and why Kennedy thinks he should get it. But they didn't, either of them, really seem to have a short, quick, clean answer, even after all of this time. And I was really struck by that. I almost expected Kennedy to have a better answer than, it's a time of crisis and I'm a younger potential challenger slash heir to the seat and a vote in me is an investment in some kind of future legacy. I was kind of surprised by that.
I agree with that, but I think in the same, if you read between the lines, it was pretty clear why Kennedy is running. I mean, if you look at him and Markey next to each other, Markey, the age difference is pretty clear. And Joe Kennedy's running for Senate because he wants to be a senator. That's why anybody would run for Senate. He wants to serve. And he was kind of making this argument that he would be able to be kind of an out front national voice. He said that the seat is a safe blue seat, so you can take more risks than if you were living in a swing district or a seat that could be taken back by a Republican. And he could be a more national voice. But I mean, here I am explaining that to you, that that's what he was saying. So I agree that the succinct answer wasn't really there.
Yeah, and it really did actually, it felt distinct from the more recent race that we've just seen of a newcomer challenging a longtime incumbent, which was the Ayanna Pressley, Michael Capuano race, where she did have a pretty clear answer about what she was bringing to the table. And I do wonder, actually, how much of this is a weakness for the Kennedy team, or if people kind of do trust that being younger, having the name recognition that he has in New England, and also kind of now watching this debate against Ed Markey, if there were any qualms that people might not have had looking at Markey's record on paper as a general progressive kind of stalwart of the Massachusetts delegation. But then seeing both of them kind of be shaky at times in explaining their positions.
Well, this is the challenge that Markey has had, I think, for the last 6 years as a senator. And part of the reason that he was vulnerable to a primary challenge like this is that he's good at being in office and getting the work done, getting on the legislation that matters to his constituents. But when it comes time to get out there and explain what he's been doing, that's not his strong point. And that's the problem that he has to solve in this race. And Joe is ahead of him by double digits, according to early polling that happened in, I think it was in September. So not the greatest metric anymore, but the last data that we do have. So it was really on Markey to kind of change the direction in this race and do something to shake it up, because he's the one who's behind. And it's not clear to me that he did that last night.
Yeah, let's talk about a few of the things that actually stuck out to us. I know one of the first things that we want to get to is, why did Ed Markey not have a better answer for the BlackRock investment question?
Well, that's a great thing to point out, because when Markey, so you might remember back in the fall, he called for a climate debate early on in the race, and Kennedy declined to attend, but Shannon Liss Reardon, who was previously running, went, and then they marketed it as more of like a climate forum, but Markey always called it a debate, whatever. The climate situation happened. And one of the big things that Liss Reardon hit him on was that he takes donations from BlackRock, which is a company that has invested in or has a stake in the Weymouth, the controversial proposed Weymouth compressor station. And she hit him on it a number of times in that forum. And then it wasn't even Kennedy who hit him on it last night. It was the moderators of the debate, Jim and Marjorie. And he really didn't have an answer. But he had plenty of time to figure out an answer to it. And so what he said was that he was against the Weymouth Compressor Station, but, you know, why not just give the money back?
Yeah, well, and so Kennedy also had a similar weakness, which is that he was, of course, hit on his assets that come from kind of fossil fuel places and asked again, why don't you divest from these? And almost gave an identical answer there, just saying, this has never impacted my vote. So Markey was saying, I've pushed back on the Weymouth front. So this clearly hasn't impacted how I advocate for my constituency. And then Kennedy said, these investments have been held for a very long time, and it hasn't impacted how I've pushed for environmental policy. So it was, again, really interesting to see both of them agree on a lot of policy points and then also defend kind of, you know, potentially politically problematic investments in the same language.
Right. And it really put a damper on the kind of climate conversation that they were about to have. And almost identically to this BlackRock thing, one of the first negative press that Kennedy got when he got into the race was about these fossil fuel holdings. So they're out there. They're talking about the Green New Deal. Kennedy talks about his new environmental justice bill. Then they get hit with this question, and then it's kind of like, oh, and then they moved on. So
yeah.
I think the climate debating that we expected, I mean, it happened, but it didn't happen quite as robustly, perhaps, because of that tricky
vulnerability.
So good on the moderators.
Definitely. One of the areas where there was some prickliness between them was around the People's Pledge. You want to update people on kind of the background there?
Oh, boy. I mean, if you read your Massachusetts playbook, you know all about the People's
Which
Pledge.
Which everyone should.
Because this has just been going on for so long. So the spark notes are Kennedy wants Markey to sign a so-called People's Pledge, which would limit outside spending in the race because there is a good chance this will be a very expensive Senate primary. Markey instead would like to update the People's Pledge to be kind of a, quote, positive People's Pledge that would allow spending from outside groups that are deemed positive who disclose their donors, but dark money groups or negative advertisement wouldn't be allowed.
When Markey was talking about what he considers good, even though apparently we get to decide that and he doesn't, but he was talking about environmental groups, for instance. Like, how much of this is just because he has endorsements with money behind them coming from environmental groups?
I think it's a great question. This was another example of how Kennedy was kind of able to box Markey in the debate. So right before, the night before, the morning of, I should say, Kennedy released a video calling on Markey to sign the People's Pledge after months before they got on the debate stage. So then, of course, it came up, and Markey was asked how his positive People's Pledge would work, and he kind of fumbled a little bit, and then he said that the media would decide which advertisements were
so
positive
exciting.
Or negative. I'm not sure I'm going to have time.
Do you have other things you're trying to cover right now? I hear there's a debate.
I don't think
tonight
I'm a very
Wednesday.
Good judge of what's positive or negative. But we're just joking around. But it was another kind of situation where Markey took the stance, but then he didn't really have a solid answer to back it up.
Right. Yeah. It was, I'd say, you know, as much as we're kind of joshing about the debate, it was illustrative about some of the weaknesses they have in kind of directly coming at each other. Where one of the biggest questions that Kennedy's gotten consistently is, hasn't Ed Markey been a good senator in all of the ways that you're saying we need a good senator? And he hasn't really formulated a neat rebuttal to that. But also, you're in kind of this difficult situation where if you have a good senator, is the argument in that case you can never run against them?
Right.
So that is kind of this tough spot that he's in right now, which is basically like, is there even a good answer to that question?
What do you think?
I don't know if there's a good answer to that question. I think I personally find it a little bit frustrating when anyone, for instance, levels the critique of a competitive primary as a distraction from somewhere else. For instance, what's going on in Maine with challenging Susan Collins. I think if you argue that Kennedy shouldn't challenge Markey because there are other campaigns happening, that's a little bit of a weird argument to make. But then I do see a lot of validity in the question of, you should have to justify why exactly you're trying to take out this specific senator. What about you?
I think you're right. And one thing that we should put in your ear to look out for in the future, so this was the first debate of many. It's only February. We have until September. And during the debate, I mean, if you read between the lines a little bit, and then the questions that both Markey and Kennedy got from reporters afterward. You know, after the debate, they go into this room and the reporters crowd around them and yell questions at them. It's very chaotic. But they both got questions about whether Markey shows up in Massachusetts enough and whether he's here enough. And even though they didn't really talk about that as much on the debate stage, Kennedy kind of said no, and he said that he's shown up in Massachusetts more than Markey has, whereas Markey said that he doesn't only show up, he stands up. So I think that issue of showing up and being present and whether you're in Massachusetts or in Washington, D.C. enough, that's going to be kind of the next thing that comes up in this race. That's my guess.
Yeah, and we'll definitely want to talk about this as the race goes on with Steve, our pollster, to see how it may or may not have shifted since
yes,
September.
Steve, we need some polls.
Come on, bring on the polls. All right. Well, let's actually shift over to Steve, shall we?
Let's do it. Laws mandating that mental health be treated with the same level of seriousness and coverage as physical health have been on the books for 20 years now. But state lawmakers are now calling out a lack of regulation that has kept mental health on the back burner for decades, leaving many people with mental illness struggling. Steve sat down with two of the senators leading the charge of the bill. So let's hear what they had to say.
Last week, the state Senate passed the Mental Health ABC Act, and I'm here with two of the people responsible for the bill, Senators Julian Cyr and Cindy Friedman. Thank you both for taking a few minutes to walk us through this.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So let's start with the basics, because news accounts of the bill say it seeks to improve access to care by identifying gaps in the mental health system, enforcing equity laws, and requiring insurance coverage for many emergency mental health services. So give us some specifics. What does this bill do, and why is it necessary right now?
Well, I think what this bill does is it sets a framework and a very solid ground for us to fix a very broken system, which is our mental health care system. Its goal is to ensure that mental health care is treated exactly like physical, medical, surgical health care. And today we all know that it's not. So there's a huge dichotomy between how we treat a med-surg and how we treat mental health. And so we have so much work to do to bring those two together and to resolve all the inequities in the mental health care system. And what I believe that this bill does is it sets a very solid ground for us to start building a system where care is accessible, where people need it and when people need it.
Yes, Cindy's absolutely right. You know, too many people in Massachusetts struggle to access the mental health services they need and they deserve and frankly have been guaranteed under law, you know, at least under parity in Massachusetts for over 20 years, over 12 years with federal law. You know, but the reasons why people have been unable to access that care are many and they're intricate. You know, as Cindy was saying, mental health care is treated differently than physical health. It's often not covered by insurance. It's difficult to access, and it's hard to talk about. And so what we did last week is, you know, we're living up to the promise that Senate President Karen Spilka has made around truly, you know, fixing this broken system and transforming mental health. That's bigger than one bill in one session. But I think what we did last week is really lay the foundation for really making sure that mental health and mental health care is treated no differently than any other health condition in the Commonwealth.
Senator Friedman, you mentioned that there's been a law on parity on the books already for a couple of decades. So why has that law not been effective, and what gaps does this new piece of legislation fill in that will make it more effective?
I think that what we've seen is that parity is – it's very nuanced it's very detailed, right? When you really break down our system of healthcare, is how do you make sure that that things are equal across across disciplines? And I think what we've seen is that when the parity laws were first put out, I don't know that there was a huge how do I say this? I'm not sure there was a great effort to ensure that there was parity. And so I believe that the way that we enforced it was very kind of general. And I think that what we saw is that it was just a lot of self-reporting, more in the line of, are you complying with the parity laws, and having insurers and payers say, yes, we are. And so what we saw was that it lagged. There was not a great effort to ensure that there was parity. It took a long time for people to realize that that we have protections and there are laws. And so now I think what we're seeing and what we've done is say, okay, we're really serious. And so what I think this bill does that's really important is it's very, very specific around how we define parity, how you tell – how you as an insurer or a payer tell us that you are meeting the requirements of parity, and how you, DOI, need to check to make sure that our insurers and our carriers are complying with the parity laws. And then there's a direct line to the legislature where we are now having oversight and able to see exactly what's going on in those spaces. So I think that's what's really fundamentally different.
Okay. And DOI, of course, Department of Insurance. Yes. So let's get into some specifics, though. What exactly will that mean? How is it being tracked? What will be different this time in terms of what we'll know about whether parity is being achieved?
So the carriers are now responsible for not only reporting that they comply, but they have to show us, for instance, what the process is for determining whether a medical surgical benefit is covered versus what the process was for that for a similar mental health benefit. Okay, so they have to actually show us how did you decide that this is covered versus how did you decide whether this is covered, meaning med-surg versus psych, so we can see did they apply the exact same process to each of those. We require them to tell us how many requests for service did you get in inpatient and outpatient, how many did you deny, how many did you change, how many were appealed, so we can track what are you doing when people think they have a benefit. We can now see whether they're being treated, whether they're being pushed back. We never had any of this information before. DOI has to ask those questions, and then DOI has to report back to us that information. We also have a piece that allows DOI to enforce those rules through penalties and through actions that would fix what those denials were. So everybody's now sitting at the table. One last thing that I think is really important is we require the carrier, the insurer, to tell us not only what they're doing, but what their carve-outs are doing. And the carve-outs are those companies that administer benefits on behalf of a insurer. And a lot of insurers carve out mental health. So they actually are not the main administrators of the benefit. They give it to another company. And so for a long time, they've been saying, yeah, you know what? I don't know. We don't do that. We give it, you know, we have a contractor that does that. So this now holds everybody along the line accountable.
So I think I can speak for everybody, really, saying we all know someone who – or a lot of people in many cases who have struggled to access and afford the mental health care that they need. Senator Scheer, you've said this bill is of particular importance to you. What's the backstory there?
Sure. You know, I've really worked hard actually to take the example that the Senate President has really given us in, you know, how she's talked about this bill and making it really personal to her family and in her life. And certainly in my life, I have friends, I have family members who struggled with mental illness, and I'm someone as well who, you know, I've grappled with anxiety and depression, especially in adolescence. For me, a lot of that had to do with being different, and folks knew I was different. And the reason I tell that and talk about that is because outpatient mental health therapy has been remarkably helpful, yes, in helping me manage my anxiety, and in helping me do things I never dreamed I could. And I think that I like to tell that, one, because I think it shows the promise of when folks get access to mental health care. And I was able to access mental health care pretty early on in college and have continued since. But I think it shows the promise of that care. But the other piece of the story that I've really sought to tell is that I have not been able to get consistent insurance coverage for my mental health care. I'm probably one of the most savvy consumers you could imagine. I'm a 34-year-old state senator. I know how to navigate bureaucracies and systems. If I can't do this, you know, imagine how many other people in the Commonwealth can't get the care they need and deserve. And so, you know, this bill tries to tackle a whole host of barriers to access. We look at workforce. But I think a big piece of this as well, in addition to the really critical parity piece, but another really important part of this is we've just got to talk about mental health and how mental health has just touched all of our lives. And I think part of the reason why it's been – part of the reason why parity laws have gone unenforced for so long, or mental health care providers have been sort of devalued within our healthcare system is the cultural piece. And so, you know, that's why I think the Senate president, myself, our colleagues have really sought to make this personal, because this is a our broken mental health system has touched, you know, if not our own lives personally, then our families and our friends. And, you know, that really, I think, merits the reason why we're passing this bill and why we need change.
Yeah, as a veteran and one of many who's received treatment for PTSD, I can say that I identify with everything that you're saying, and the access piece, even for someone who's trying really hard and cares a lot about getting the care that they need, is not easy.
It's yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was fortunate to have a conversation with former Congressman Kennedy, who's really been a leader on this through the Kennedy Forum. This is Patrick Kennedy, who served in the Representative Rhode Island in Congress for years and was a real leader on the federal parity law, and has since has founded the Kennedy Forum, which is really focused on these issues. He really talks about the need of folks to come out and to come out about our challenges around mental health, and that's something I certainly can resonate with as someone who's LGBTQ. And I think that the more we talk about mental health in our own personal lives and our families, I think that's going to do just as much as the really critical pieces that we're putting in statute around accountability, around enforcing parity, around incentives, around a workforce. There's a whole host of sort of access pieces that are in this bill.
And are those the kinds of issues that you tend to hear about from constituents? I mean, do you get calls to your offices from people that are trying to navigate a system which you're looking to make easier?
All the time. I mean, I think we field probably at least one call a week.
Absolutely.
For somebody who is trying desperately to get help. And it's more often than not, it's around their children and finding access. And, you know, this area of medicine is complex. You don't hand somebody a pill and say, see you later, take one a day, we'll see you, you know, in 30 years when we'll check your blood pressure. It's much more nuanced. It takes a lot more work to, you know, help people with the care that they need. And we don't have a system that's very good at dealing with the complexities of this. You know, it costs a lot, and it all comes down to cost. Everything is driven by cost. And so what we see, especially in the children's space, is that people don't want to take on these children because it's expensive, or it's, you know, or who's going to pay, or, you know, how long is this going to last? And these kids really, really suffer, and they suffer for reasons that they shouldn't be. They're suffering because the adults in the room can't get together and say, no, we really need to fix this. And so I think this bill, one of the things that I'm most happy about in this bill is the piece we have around the ED boarding, emergency department boarding, and really putting a very clear limit on how long a child can sit in an ED without being evaluated and without having some plan in place to get them out of the emergency room. We hear from parents all the time who find – we are like the last call they make, and they say, my son is 17 years old. He is sitting in an emergency room, a room with no windows, can't get out, has a security guard on the other side, and it's been 45 days because we can't find a placement for him, or they can't find a placement for him. And when you look at it, when you dig down, it's about the cost. Who's going to pay? And that's just unconscionable. And so we hear this all the time. And between that and the provider networks that are really non-existent, where you make 60 phone calls to find somebody to treat, and by the 60th phone call, you have not found one person. Sometimes it's a pizza delivery numbers. Sometimes the provider has passed away. The number's wrong. I mean, there's so much wrong with the system that you can be overwhelmed.
Well, it sounds like there certainly is a lot of work to do, and the bill passed unanimously out of the Senate. So very quickly, where does it go from here? What are the next steps for this bill, and when might it actually be passed into law?
I think first on this bill, in the days since we've passed this, I have received, and Cindy has received, and the Senate president and all of our colleagues have received, this just outpouring of messages and notes and people just saying, you know, thank you so much for doing this. And I think we've really struck a chord with people. And I think that is going to really propel what's a really, you know, good set of policies that we need to get done is going to get it propelled this session. I'm working with my counterpart, Representative Marjorie Decker. We both chair the Joint Committee on Mental Health Substance Use Recovery. We're hopeful that the committee is going to put out a bill focused on children. Perhaps that's a vehicle for which we can reconcile these. But I think that the policy has really, you know, the time has come to, you know, move forward on these policy changes. I think we've also been really honest, you know, as Senator Friedman said at the outset, that this is the beginning of a process. We can't fix this broken system in one bill or one session. And so we'll be coming back to this again and again and again until we truly have, you know, a mental health care delivery system that's integrated, that's getting people the care they need. It's going to take quite a bit of work, but I'm really proud of the sort of first step, the foundation we've laid with this legislation, and I hope we can get it done before July 31st.
All right. Well, Senator Julian Sears, Senator Cindy Friedman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So that brings us to trivia. Last week we asked you who said this quote, and here's the quote. I love Concord. Oh, Concord. You know how famous Concord is? Concord. That's the same Concord that we read about all the time, right? Concord. I love Concord. And the answer, of course, was President Donald Trump, who was confusing Concord, New Hampshire with Concord, Massachusetts during his visit to Manchester, New Hampshire last week, right before the New Hampshire primary.
He's in some interesting form as far as confusing cities with identical names in different states, if we're thinking about Kansas City, Missouri versus Kansas City, Kansas. So I do like this trend.
Honestly, at the end of primary week, I had no idea where I was in there.
That's fair. So this week, we're going to ask for something a little bit different. We haven't run this by Steve, so we're going to see how this goes.
So you guys have to participate.
You have to participate. Come on, make this work. We would like to hear from you, and not just from you. We would like to hear you and your mellifluous tones, because as you might have noticed from the intro, Stephanie Murray has been trying to make a debate night song happen, and I propose that maybe there are some other tunes, maybe some other parody songs that we could be working with here. My proposal is Saturday Night's All Right for Debating. And we would like to hear your contributions.
That's right. So a song parody themed around the debate that is better than my debate night song, which I think is impossible to do, but maybe you'll surprise us. And if your contribution is particularly good, maybe we will play it on the pod next week.
That's true. Maybe we'll set it to the state polka. Ooh, what if there's a crossover with the state polka?
I don't even know what to say to that.
Well, we'll listen reverently. And so in the meantime, thank you, everyone, for listening to us this week. So remember to subscribe to the podcast, rate us and leave reviews so other people can find it. Subscribe to Stephanie's newsletter at Politico Massachusetts. And until next time, I'm Jennifer Smith.
And I'm Stephanie Murray. Thanks so much for listening.